As always on Gaza Corner, if you go to the Tangents website, tangents.com, Harry the Playlist Guru has already set the table for you. All the links are there for the information that inspired this particular Gaza Corner. You'll see an article from The Guardian UK called A Journey Through the Past, Lost Music of the Palestinian Uprising is Restored. And what this is about is a London-based Palestinian Bedouin actor, filmmaker. He's a DJ, a music producer, an archivist, and originally from Jenin in the West Bank in Palestine. And his name is Momin Swatat. And he trained at the Freedom Theater in Jenin. And it's a very famous theater that was founded during the First Intifada in the late 1980s on the premise of taking the Palestinian cause to the people through theater. And if you fast forward to March of 2020, I was actually in Palestine right at the end of February, just as COVID was hitting. Then there was a lockdown not too long after that. That's what happened to Momin Swatat. As COVID swept through the world in the spring of 2020, Israel went into lockdown, and he found himself stranded in what was his hometown, Jenin. And he took quiet walks, and he came upon a music shop that was closed called Tariq Cassettes. But he remembered this shop. Actually, it wasn't closed due to COVID. It had been closed for years and years. But he was really anxious and inspired to somehow see if he could find out if they still had the archives of all the cassettes that used to be in that shop. So he managed to connect with the former owner, who gave him access to what was left in the store before it was closed, all these cassette tapes. And what he discovered was a musical treasure. It was the music that enlivened Palestinian life when the first Intifada broke out in the late 1980s, but was now long forgotten. During the first Intifada, the first uprising of the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation, songs became the spaces, if you will, for the articulation of the uprising. And Swatat, I mean, the guy must have loved him. My God, the store is closed, and he goes to the archive. He ends up buying five suitcases of cassettes, and he returned to London determined to digitize them and to somehow re-release this music. Quoting Swatat, "I listened to 10,000 tapes over 8 months, lots of synth stuff and funk and disco, wedding music, revolutionary tracks. I even found recordings made by my uncle, who was in a Bedouin wedding band. One of the special finds was this bright yellow tape with no information on it except a sticker with the handwritten word Intifada." If you go to the Tangents playlist at tangents.com, you will see a photo of this cassette. Normally, the musicians, the Palestinians, wouldn't put their name on it because, as it turned out, Israel started arresting musicians during the Intifada. So they didn't want to have their name on it. But after listening to the music, at the very, very end of the cassette, after silence, all of a sudden, the artist's voice emerges. And he thanks his family. He thanks the late Palestinian national poet Mahmoud Darwish. He wrote the lyrics to one of the songs. And he found out the guy's name. Riyadh Awad, Awwad. So we tried to look up Riyadh Awad's information online, as anyone would, but he could find nothing. But he did track down his sister Hanan. And then he learned the details behind the making of the Intifada album. Quoting his sister Hanan, quote, "He had a unique style, and he made music about identity, which resonated with our people a lot. If you went down Salah al-Din Street in the Old City in Jerusalem, everyone was playing it." The Old City is the Palestinian quarter. When the Intifada escalated, Israeli forces confiscated all of his tapes. He had like 3,000. They confiscated them all. And then they detained him for several months, during which time he was tortured. He died in 2005 in a car accident. And Swatat was determined to not only release so much of the music that he took back in these five suitcases, but particularly to release the Intifada album. And as it turned out, he got funding from Jerwood Arts, J-E-R Wood Arts, which is an independent funder in the UK supporting artists. And that enabled Swatat to start the Majaz. It's like Ma and Jazz, Majaz Project. And it's linked at the Tangents playlist. It's one of the links there. You can learn about it. And it's an archive of vintage Palestinian and Arab vinyl and cassettes. And Swatat has now created a record label based at East London's Finch Cafe. And he runs a residency program where he hosts various artists. The digital release of Awad's Intifada album has already happened. It was launched through the Majaz Project label at the end of last year, 2021, which means just a couple of weeks ago. And the vinyl version is scheduled for launch in April, although it's already sold half its run. Quoting Swatat, "So much Palestinian culture has been lost or locked up in Israeli military archives, so it's magical to find this. It's a journey through the past and the future of a whole people," unquote. So I went to the Majaz website, and there's a SoundCloud page. And again, you can find the SoundCloud link at the Tangents playlist. And there's a mix that Momin Swatat did. It's over an hour, so I'm obviously not going to play that, but I found a five-minute song within it that I think is really cool. I have no idea who's singing, but I really do like it. So this is a mix from Momin Swatat, a song from one of the many, many cassettes he discovered at that shuttered music shop in Jenin when he was sheltering in place during COVID in early kind of March of 2020 on Gaza Corner. Right, that is a Lebanese singer by the name of Mona Mirachli, Mona Mohammed Mirachli, who was known for interpreting Kulthum, for example, also recorded songs with many composers, including the Rabbani brothers, who, of course, the Rabbani brothers in Fairuz were just bonded at the hip, and that particular song was included on a over hour mix that was put together by Momim Swatat, who was the subject of the first part of a Gaza Corner, who discovered all of these cassettes and also vinyl, and obviously on that one, lots of snap, crackle, and pop on that particular track as he rescued this music from a dusty archive in Jenin during COVID and was on lockdown and then went back to London, has digitized it, created his own record label. And there's a link to the entire mix at the Tangents playlist. The first musician, the very first musician who was arrested for the crime of making music in Palestine was Suhail Khoury. Suhail Khoury is the director of the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music, which is in various, has various branches. He's at the one in East Jerusalem, and the others are in the West Bank and one in Gaza. And when I was in Israel in 2015, I made a point to go to East Jerusalem and meet Suhail Khoury. And he has quite a story about that particular time. This was 1988 during the first Intifada. And we're going to hear a little bit of the interview I did with Suhail Khoury. First, I want to quote from his wife, Rania Elias. She says, "My husband, Suhail Khoury, was arrested and spent several months in an Israeli prison after he was caught at a checkpoint during the Intifada, transporting hundreds of cassettes of his music calling for freedom and struggle against Israeli occupation. I remember a statement by the Palestinian author Twafiq Zayad saying, quote, 'I never carried a rifle on my shoulder or pulled a trigger. All I have is a naze, a flutes, if you will, melody, a brush to paint my dreams, a bottle of ink. All I have is unshakable faith and an infinite love for my people in pain.'" Unquote. She goes on to say, "This is what my husband has always been carrying in his heart." So let's go back to 2015. This is at the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music. And I was asking Suhail, we would say Khoury, K-O-U-R-Y, but you don't really say the K so much. The way it's actually pronounced is more Khoury. And when I was talking to Suhail, I was asking him about the time that he was arrested for the music that he had recorded during the first Intifada.
What was so subversive about what your music was saying?
I think they were just going crazy at the time. They were trying all sorts of ways to stop the uprising. So they were cracking on stone throwers. They were breaking their bones. You know, if they caught somebody, they would break their bones with stone, with the stones themselves. And they were trying to stop it in any way possible. So when this music was released, they dealt with it as if these were bombs rather than cassettes of music. It was the only time that they had, you know, taken and confiscated a car that was carrying anything was when it was carrying weapons. And that was the only time that, you know, a car carrying cassettes was confiscated. So they were equating cassettes with music with you know, arms, which was crazy. But they were actually, you know, bringing the cassette to the court and, you know, trying to convince the judge that these were very provocative music that was calling people to revolt, which is, I mean, we were calling people to revolt against the occupation, which is very natural and supposed to be like that. They didn't like it. So they put me in prison, confiscated the cassettes and the car.
So the song overtly calls people up to rise, or is it more of a metaphorical way of doing this?
Some of them were metaphorical. Others were actually, you know, straightforward. And they were more or less, you know, telling the stories of what was happening. That was why maybe they were so powerful. They were very fresh. You know, the songs were just talking about something that just happened the month before and activities that were happening during the Intifada, you know, the uprising. So they were very powerful songs that moved the people on the streets.
How were you treated in prison?
The first 12 days were very difficult because I was tortured. They wanted to know who had done what in this production, you know, who wrote the lyrics, who had sung, who had played the music and whatever. And then after they got tired of this and couldn't get anything, they wanted to try to relate me to a political faction, which I was not, so that they can, you know, put me in prison somehow, because they had never, I mean, it was, they had never condemned somebody for doing music. So they wanted to find somewhere to put me in prison. They finally found a British law that said, you know, if you're inciting people or helping somebody to incite to do violence or something, and they convinced the judge that this was inciting people to revolt. So they put me in prison 6 months.
Can you, if you're comfortable describing it, can you describe, when you say torture, what was done?
Now I can talk about this, but, you know, for many years I couldn't really. But this is already
27 years ago.
So it's sort of history now. The secret, the people in the interrogation chambers are very careful not to torture without leaving signs. So you don't have the kind of torture where you have, you know, strikes on your back or whatever, things like this that you can find some in other regimes, where, for example, in Latin America or the some Arab dictatorships or some. But it's more... It's more severe and more painful, to a point where they actually want to get something out of you and not just beat you for the heck of it. So they would use for example, not allow you to sleep for several days by keeping somebody there and people coming back and forth hitting you all the time. So even if you're, you know, unable to stand or whatever, they would try to keep you awake so that you are not really aware of what you're saying or what's happening around you. You are usually handcuffed to a pole in the wall with your hands back, and then there's a stinking bag on top of your head. And
are you talking excrement? I mean, what's making this stink?
They urinate in it.
Okay.
And then they put it on top of on your head, so you can, you know, you are almost unable to breathe through it.
Yeah.
And of course you're left in the, whether it is cold or hot, you're left in the outside, under the sun or under the rain and whatever, depending on the time. When I was there, it was in the summer, in July. Then, of course, they would, in the interrogation chambers, I was, on one of the occasions, I was put on a chair without a back. And the interrogator would be sitting on the table with his foot in my, what do you call it?
Crotch.
Yeah. And the other foot would be on my chest. And my hands are handcuffed from behind. So he would ask me, and whenever, you know, he doesn't like, this is like it, he would just, you know, what do you call this? He would just push me in the crotch or hit me with his foot in my chest. And then there's no back for the chair, so you always are sort of halfway back. And if I will fall, he would, you know, take me back and keep me in this position, so that there is always tension here. He He would hit here and here, in the crotch and on the chest. Now, he has shoes that don't, you know, don't make a sign or
a mark.
A mark. At one point, after a session like this, I was hit very hard. That I thought afterwards that when they put me back to this position, or what we call shabih, I thought I was going to die, because I thought my heart would not take it. But then I sort of came to me that he hit me that hard because he lost you know, this session, he lost the battle, because he couldn't get anything out of it. And when their aim is basically to get you talking. So if you're not talking and they hit you hard, there's some kind of adrenaline comes to your body, and you are more
you're more stronger.
Yes.
Because you realize he's losing the battle to get information, and he's having to hit you harder out of frustration.
Exactly.
So you realize actually that you're winning, and it gives you strength.
Yes, but this doesn't happen at the time when it's happening, because you're being beaten. But then afterwards, when I was taken out of the chamber and put in the courtyard where I'm handcuffed again to this pole, and feeling that my heart is going to stop, and then I realized that I have won the battle because they couldn't get anything out of it. At that time, this music came to me, which is called Nasr. Nasr is victory. So I felt that I won this small battle. For me, it was a huge thing. And the theme of this music came into my head, and I started, you know, humming it while I was there.
Can you hum it?
Goes on. Later I, of course, developed it, and it became a piece of music. Another piece was Shabih. I think I'm confusing the names. I think this was Shabih that I just said, which was the when I felt this emotion. And then the other song, Nasr, was when I felt this, and it had another tune. Tira ri ra ri ra ri ra ra ram. Tira ri ra ra ri ra ra ra. And then there was a call from far away. You will hear this in the tape, because there is a call. It's sort of calling the Arabs. Ya Arab, huh? And the what came to me at that time was basically saying, if I, with, you know, only my body, I have nothing to fight with my music and my body, I could win this small battle. You know, why can't you Arabs, you know, win back Palestine?
Inshallah.
And basically, these were two songs from that from these 12 days of difficult torture. There are many things, but I'm not going to get into all the details of that at this time. There was another song that I did again from prison. It was from Atlit to Naqab. Tahiyyah. It's basically, Atlit is the prison that I was in north of Palestine, like south of Haifa. And several of my colleagues who I used to work with in a dance group were the poet, the choreographers, and many other dancers were in a prison in the desert, in the south. And so I made a plastic flute in prison. I used to make these before I went into prison. These knives. The knife is, it's a bamboo flute, actually. But we didn't have the bamboo needed, so I used to do them with plastic. So I went into prison, and I was one day laying on my on the bed. It's a camp prison, so these are tents, and there are double deck beds in each tent. So I was on the top, and I was close to the ceiling of the tent. And there was, a bulb, a light in the tent. And the electric wiring was covered by this round tubing, which was, you know, that's what I used to make my flutes from. So I got the idea. I went up, I unscrewed the wires, pulled out this tubing, and put the wires back again using some kind of a, you know, knife that we were able to eat with. And then I cut it, and with a nail, I was heating the nail. And, you know, with a heated nail, you can go through the plastic. So I made the holes, and I made this flute. And with that, I started this piece of music. Later, when I recorded it, I actually used the clarinet to do it. I thought it was more expressive with this kind of tune that I used. And this is track 7 in the CD.
Did you make nays for other people too, or was this
this was your
one nay in prison?
Yes, and actually it got confiscated.
Well, that's not surprising.
Well, actually I had it all through, but when I was leaving, it's like a 60 centimeter, something like 24 inch pipe. So, and it, when I went out, I had a backpack, and it was protruding from the backpack because it was a bit longer. So the security officer said, "What is this?" And I said, "This is a flute." And he went crazy. How did I smuggle a flute into the prison? I said, you know, I didn't. It's from here. So I said, so he started to be nasty, and then I said, you know, this is how I did it. He said, so at the end he said, ah, so this is a property of the State of Israel, and so he confiscated it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.